Good evening. I am John Buchanan, pastor of Fourth Presbyterian Church, and it is my great pleasure to welcome you to this special Michigan Avenue Forum, one in a series of occasional conversations on issues of importance to the nation and our community. This church sits on one of the busiest urban intersections in the world, and we understand part of our mission to be a place where faith and culture meet. National Public Radio is an important part of my life, from car talk to All Things Considered to Prairie Home Companion, and of course, Speaking of Faith, and all points between a daily thoughtful companion. So it is a real honor for me to welcome you to this event featuring Krista Tippett and Eboo Patel, a colleague and important voice for understanding and reconciliation. And now to introduce this evening's program, the Reverend Adam Fronczek, my colleague on the staff, whose responsibilities include adult education and this Michigan Avenue Forum. Adam Fronczek.
Good evening to all of you. I hope you'll indulge me for a few moments while I thank the partners who are involved in tonight's event. This event's a partnership between several groups. We are here as part of the Chicago Public Radio Presents live event series. American Public Media and the Interfaith Youth Corps are to be thanked for their generous support and encouragement of tonight. And here at Fourth Presbyterian Church, this is part of our Michigan Avenue Forum series, which celebrates speakers who do all kinds of innovative and important work at the intersection of faith and life. Each of tonight's partners, in their own way, seek to increase understanding and dialogue among people from different walks of life. We are all happy to welcome you here tonight, and if this is your first time at Fourth Church or a Michigan Avenue Forum, I want to extend a special welcome to you and say that we would love to see you again. Please find one of our members of the Adult Education Committee on your way out. They are wearing big purple name tags and are easy to identify. We'd be glad to take your name and email address and keep you informed regarding other adult education events in the life of this active congregation. Tonight's program features two people whose life and work exemplifies the shared mission of the partners I mentioned. Krista Tippett and Eboo Patel both work to increase understanding and expand dialogue among different people who live in a diverse world. Ms. Tippett is the host of Speaking of Faith, Public Radio's weekly program about religion, meaning, ethics, and ideas. With a professional background in political life, theology, and broadcast journalism, she really does operate at the intersection between faith and life. From week to week, as she talks on her program with theologians and scientists, poets and parents, educators and physicians, both religious and non-religious, her interviews bring us closer to the kind of understanding and dialogue our world so desperately needs. Tonight, the tables are turned, and Ms. Tippett will be our interviewee. Asking the questions will be Eboo Patel, founder and executive director of the Interfaith Youth Corps. The Interfaith Youth Corps builds mutual respect and pluralism among young people from different religious traditions by empowering them to work together to serve others. What a great opportunity it promises to be to hear these two innovative leaders and thinkers in conversation about evolving faith, meaning, ethics, and ideas. Please welcome Krista Tippett and Eboo Patel.
Well, welcome Chicagoans to Fourth Presbyterian Church. Welcome national radio audience to Chicago. Welcome everybody to a very special evening with Krista Tippett. A great Sufi poet said, the goal is to generate light and not heat. And if there is one subject that causes a great deal of heat, it's discussions about religion. And if there's one person who is illuminating a path of reason, of warmth, of generosity around that topic, it's Krista Tippett. And it is a great joy to welcome you to Chicago tonight.
Thank you.
So I've been asked to point out that the audience here at Fourth Pres has been given a note card, and that's for questions that if you feel the need to ask a question, scribble it down on that, and you will hand them to the end of the aisle about midway through the program. They will be vetted by Krista's executive producer, Kate Moose, and then they will be handed to me. And if you are part of our national radio audience, you don't have to write your question down, just shout it to the person sitting next to you. And it probably won't be vetted. And there you go. So you have a special opportunity tonight. So I run an organization called the Interfaith Youth Corps. And we had the great joy of having Krista and Kate come by and join us for a lunchtime conversation. And Krista shared some of the tricks of the trade of being an interviewer. And she said the best first question to ask is, tell me about the spirituality of your childhood. And so as I was walking here this evening, making my final preparations, I figured I would prove to you all how quick a learner I am. Krista, tell us about the spirituality of your childhood.
Good job, Hebrew.
Thank you. NPR 101.
Mm-hmm. I want to say how incredible it is to see everyone here tonight. What an incredible welcome to Chicago this is, and I'm thrilled. I'm often not even in the room with the person I'm interviewing, much less this many listeners. So, well, I grew up in Oklahoma, and I grew up Southern Baptist, and that was pretty much the only game in town, in this small town called Shawnee. Church was not just a place that you went actually twice on Sunday and once on Wednesday. It was the fabric of life. It was the whole culture. It was infused. The whole culture was infused with religion, which also meant that religion had a lot in it that wasn't about religion, but that was about culture. And my grandfather was a Southern Baptist minister, and I wrote about him when I wrote my book a couple of years ago, and actually it was that was a wonderful opportunity for me to sit down and think about some of the questions I ask other people, like this one. And my grandfather was incredibly, incredibly stern in his theology, and he was a preacher of hellfire and brimstone. But my experience of him was full of contradiction and contrast. So he was preaching hellfire and brimstone, and he was also one of the funniest people I'd ever met. He didn't mean this, but the God he portrayed to me through his sermons was very stern and harsh, and yet my grandfather was deeply loving. And I also got an idea early on that I wasn't invited to bring all of my mind into the practice of this religion, that I had to kind of separate parts of myself out and some of my questions. And that was true of the religion my grandfather taught, and yet he was also incredibly smart. He was not educated, he had second grade education. And I think that what I did is I didn't just take in the God he preached, I took in the wholeness of his life as well. And so even though, if you looked at some rote description of the religion of my childhood, it would look pretty narrow. But what I came away with spiritually was much bigger and was a bit puzzling and mysterious, and that's how I think of it all now still.
So you enter into some of that mystery in your book, Speaking of Faith, which is beautiful. And part of what you write about is your years as a journalist and as a diplomatic aide in divided Berlin in the 1980s. And it must have seemed in some ways like the center of the world. And you have this beautiful line, you say that you didn't have enough conviction to call yourself an agnostic. You didn't think about religion much at all.
Yeah, I didn't even think it was that important to give myself a label. Yes.
But there was a spiritual awakening which took place soon after that, your time in other parts of the continent, your time in the British Isles. Tell us about that spiritual awakening that took place during your young adulthood.
So the thing about religion being a part of the world I inhabited is that when I left that world geographically, there was no place for this faith of my childhood. It wasn't part of the texture of things anymore. And also, just like a lot of people, I was 18, I went to college, I moved on to other things. Religion wasn't that interesting. I actually am fascinated, and I think you're more in touch with this than I am, by how religion is quite interesting to people in college these days. But in the late 70s, early 80s, it wasn't. I got really caught up in the division of the world of that time between communism and capitalism and the Soviet Union and the United States, these categories that I find very difficult to explain to my children. They kind of don't believe me, right, about the Cold War and about the Soviet Union. I ended up going to Germany, to divided Germany, to divided Berlin, which were microcosms of this great conflict. And I can also see some of that in theological terms. You know, it really did feel like this great battle between good and evil, and for a battle for salvation, in a sense. It was thrilling. It was actually thrilling on a moral level as well as at a political and strategic level. And I ended up writing for the New York Times in Berlin, and then being hired by the chief American diplomat in Berlin. I tried to live on both sides of the wall. The wall came down on my 29th birthday. Did you know that? And so
we
I just
to
had
share
a birthday last
actually.
Week. Do we? Did the wall come down on your birthday?
November 9th.
It's an important day in history.
There you go.
So here's the thing. In Berlin, I had friends on both sides of the wall. And what it eventually came down to for me were human dynamics. I knew people on the eastern side of the wall who had nothing, right? They didn't starve. Materially, they didn't have abundance, but they also didn't have an abundance of things that I took for granted, like choice. They didn't have an abundance of possibility. They couldn't dream. And that was all so painful. And yet, I knew people who carved out these lives of incredible integrity, who poured themselves into their intimate relationships, who created very meaningful lives. On the western side of the wall, people had everything. I mean, and not just materially. They could get in an airplane and fly over East Germany and have a vacation, you know, wherever they wanted to. They had all the possibilities I had of public power and of a life path that they could help define. And I knew a lot of really miserable people. And I also knew a lot of people. I ended up working at really high, exalted levels of government, of military strategy, of political strategy. And there was a contrast between the genuine power and substance of people's professional lives and their knowledge, their expertise, and then I found that it was possible to be a great expert in important issues and be really small inwardly, to invest outwardly and not inwardly. And so these were not lives of integrity. And I was at that age where I was still asking. I was in my mid-20s. I had some great credentials, but I was still asking, what do I want to be when I grow up, and where do I want to invest my energy? And all of this made me think that there were dynamics at the level of human life, which I wasn't ready to call spiritual yet, but eventually I would, which maybe were more important than the possibility that nuclear weapons might do away with it all. That you know, I started thinking about what is life with a capital L, what is death with a capital D, and so that eventually led me to spiritual questions and to thinking about taking religion seriously, because I saw religion as a place that does want to address life with a capital L and death with a capital D. But if I was going to be religious again, I had to be able to absolutely bring my mind to it. And I had to know that religion could matter in the face of the complexity of the world that I'd experienced. And that's why I went to study theology, to test that.
No, in this chapter of your book, you write a lot about Bonhoeffer. Mm-hmm. And in my own kind of spiritual awakening as a young adult, it was faith heroes that played a huge role. Dorothy Day, Bonhoeffer, the Dalai Lama, Gandhi, in reconnecting me with my tradition, which is Islam. Tell us the role that Bonhoeffer and others played for you in the reconnection to faith.
Well, there were years when I was in college where I was able to get intellectually excited about some religious thinkers, even though I didn't have a religious life, and Bonhoeffer was one of those people, because I was fascinated with German history and with the great moral and political trauma and turmoil of German history. And Dietrich Bonhoeffer was this theological figure, great theologian, great biblical scholar, who also his life ended because he threw himself, he was a pacifist, and he ended up throwing himself behind a plot to kill Hitler. That in that moment, that was the ethical choice. He felt his faith calling him to. I was also really interested, and I find myself actually in these years now, coming back to this phrase that Bonhoeffer coined, which he never got to develop because he died, of religionless Christianity. Bonhoeffer was very interested in ideas and virtues that Christianity brings into the world, which he felt could survive even the collapse of the institution of the church. In his Germany, the church, the Christian church, had been completely co-opted by fascism, and so it wasn't recognizable. But he was very sure that there was an essence of truth and of wisdom there, but it might be disconnected from the institutions. And I think that right now in this age we inhabit, a lot of people are taking charge of their religious and spiritual lives in a way they haven't before in history. People aren't necessarily growing up as connected to the institutions. I mean, I bet there was a time when people were born into families who'd gone to this church for generations and generations. It's much more fluid now. A lot of people are finding their way back to the institution. But first of all, maybe by having this experience that Bonhoeffer was describing of rediscovering an essence of something, rediscovering ideas and virtues, and then going back to institutions to find places that honor that in sacrament and community and text.
You know, it's interesting, you asked earlier about young adults and religious connection, and that's what we do at the Interfaith Youth Court. I'm just thinking, as I'm remembering your book and something about my journey, one of the things that faith heroes provide are models of integrity and consistency,
right,
and courage. And one thinks back to the 20th century and who made a difference at various turning points in that century. It was people of faith. And I remember being in college and listening to, you know, what my college professors were saying in sociology lectures, but not watching them live that out in their private,
right,
lives. And then encountering Dorothy Day or Dietrich Bonhoeffer or Mahatma Gandhi, and when they had a recognition about the world, they felt called to then live that recognition. And I wonder if that's, you were saying earlier at the Interfaith Youth Corps, there's this call to authenticity,
mm-hmm,
in this era and amongst young people.
This generation is insisting on authenticity. you know, when I was at Interfaith Youth Corps with you today, we also talked about how politics is changing. We've been kind of focused in past generations on whether politicians bring their religious, you know, whether they make their religious positions clear or not. I think as we move forward in politics, as in other spheres of life, we will know more about, let's say, where people's moral bearings are, and perhaps their religious identity as well. But it's not going to be because we want to know their position. It's going to be because this generation is saying, I want to know who you are as a whole person. Is this part of you, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Where is your anchoring? What's the source of your ethical discernment? How do you measure your own integrity? The generations coming up want to know this of people who are their leaders. And I think that's going to be good for all of us, because we compartmentalize these things after the 1960s.
So let's talk a little bit about speaking of faith. I imagine that it emerged in your head partially as a result of your own spiritual awakening and exploration, as a result of a variety of things happening in the culture. Speak a bit about the launching of Speaking of Faith.
So in the mid-90s, I had come out of divinity school. I had found absolutely that my mind, that theology and religious life could be as intellectually thrilling as it is spiritually thrilling. And I discovered this whole world of people I was reading and people I was communicating with who you know, there was a whole world of living into that. And at the same time, when I came out of divinity school, this was the mid-90s, this was the era where Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, you know, basically two people, not only spoke for who religious people are, who Christians are, but were handed those platforms by my fellow journalists, right? I mean, media gave them that very loud, powerful voice they had. And long after they even were really speaking for most evangelical Christians. So there's this collusion of what's wrong with our media culture and what can go wrong with religion. I love public radio, and I moved to Minnesota, which is where public radio is a huge part of the fabric of culture. And I just felt like this was the black hole, right? I mean, public radio could speak innovatively and intelligently about politics and economics and the arts, and it could fill in the gaps that other media wasn't getting at. But this subject was terrifying, and I did understand that. I understood that we didn't have any models for talking about this in a way that was not proselytizing, that would not feel exclusive, that would not feel inflammatory. I mean, people were really convinced that if we put religious voices on the air, the radio dials would go off. This was in the day of radio dials. That's how quickly the world has changed. I just, you know, I can almost not, because it was a big battle and it was hard for years, but I became so passionate about the idea that precisely because this subject was so hard to talk about and because we'd gotten it so wrong, we had to work that much, we had to risk finding some new ways to bring it out. And then I also knew it was really important in life and in the world in ways that we didn't know how to articulate. This was before the 2004 presidential election. It was before 9/11 when, you know, religion came out into the headlines again in a new way.
I remember writing my thesis at Oxford on issues of Muslim religious education. And people were like, that's the most obscure topic you can think of, right? This is in 1998, a couple years later. All of a sudden, people wanted to read chapter 5 of my thesis, the most obscure chapter in that seemingly obscure thesis.
And here's the thing. Even then, Islam was a religion of over a billion people, the second largest religion in the world, was set to become the second largest religion in the United States. People hadn't woken up to that. And it was a tragic, tragic way in which people in this country woke up to Islam as this huge, important global religion.
There's a great title for a Raymond Carver story, What We Talk About When We Talk About Love. And I often think about your show as What We Talk About When We Talk About Faith. And I love that you go back in your book to the tradition of public theology and connect speaking of faith to what Tillich was trying to do, what Niebuhr was trying to do, what King was trying to do. Talk about speaking of faith as the practice of public theology.
Well, what I like to think about is how public theology, is speaking of faith and the practice of public theology as it must be in the 21st century, which as much as I love Reinhold Niebuhr, and he's one of the most quotable people who ever wrote, if you talk about religion. Public theology is going to be different in the 21st century than it was in 50 years ago. And public theologians are not going, and can't all be white, male, Protestant, Christian. No kind of person has a privileged voice like a Reinhold Niebuhr could have in American life 40 years ago, 50 years ago. On the other hand, the public theologians in a neighborhood, in a religious congregation, in a workplace, have access to a global audience because of the internet. So And here's the other thing. Public theology, like, and speaking of faith is not really a show about religion, right? I mean, sometimes we take on an explicitly religious topic or a religious leader, but often it's about people leading lives of integrity and virtue and discovery. And they may be scientists, or they may be, you know, parents or police officers, or educators. And how does theology, imagined as something generous and large, and imagined as something that perhaps goes beyond monotheism, how does that flow into all of the things we do, all of our kinds of action in the world? And how are our ideas about God and of what is sacred, how are those formed by what somebody's learning as a geophysicist or a neuroscientist or a parent? So I see public theology evolving right now as we speak, and I like to think that the show is, you know, maybe part of that evolution or a reflection of that evolution. And, you know, that's a journey. And
so let's hang out here for a minute. There's a great line by the Chicago band Wilco. Theologians, they don't know nothing about my soul. Mm. And I thought about that as I was rereading your book this past weekend in your interviews with Karen Armstrong on the subject of amateur theologians. Mm. I think this is part of this notion of you requiring folks on your show to speak from their experience, not necessarily as authorities, and this notion of anybody in a cubicle or a hovel anywhere has access to a worldwide audience. So talk about amateur theologians and public theology and religion in the 21st century.
Well, the way Karen Armstrong brings us back to the root of the word amateur, which is a lover, an amateur theologian, lover of theology. And when I said a minute ago that people in our time are taking their spiritual life, taking charge of their spiritual lives, even people who are deeply planted in religious institutions, even maybe that person who did grow up in a church or a synagogue and has continued to live to worship there all of their lives, they're reading books, you know, they're exploring, they're working on projects like the kinds of service projects that you work on, of issues of common human concern like the environment or poverty or political justice, and they're encountering religious others, and they're learning things from people from different traditions. So there's a way in which people are becoming amateur theologians. It's not necessarily that they're setting out to, but there's a lot of opportunity to do theology, which is just great. It's really exciting. It's a little different from the soul, right? What did you say? Theologians, they don't know anything about my soul?
Right. And maybe Jeff Tweedy used that because it rhymed in the song.
Well, it's good. Well, here's what I want to add something to that, though, because that's important, too. A person I've learned from and who shaped my approach to the interviews I do is Parker Palmer, who's a Quaker thinker and educator. And in a little book he wrote, which is called Let Your Life Speak, which is a Quaker saying, which is very beautiful, he talked about how in this culture, we are very good at bringing our intellects to the public table, into our public discourse. We know how to formulate and express opinions. And we've also, you know, recently in a few decades, gotten very good at bringing our emotions into our public life. But that to bring the insights of the soul into our most important discussions is something different again. And very intimate, you know, I always want to point this out. One reason we haven't done a great job of talking about religion and spirituality in public is because it's as intimate as anything we can try to talk about. And it's good for us to remember that. And what Parker says is that in order for the soul to speak its truths, we need to create quiet, inviting, and trustworthy spaces. And that's countercultural in 2009 in the United States of America. It's countercultural in media, but what I try to do, essentially when I begin a conversation for the show, I try to create a quiet, inviting, and trustworthy space for that conversation. And I hope that the program as a whole creates a quiet, inviting, and trustworthy space for the listener. And so, you know, I guess what I'm saying is that we don't just need resources of elite teachers and ideas and books and communities, but we need to create a different atmosphere, an atmosphere that may be countercultural, to go more deeply into this part of our common life, even.
I just want to remind folks about those note cards and questions. I think that we're going to be collecting them in a few minutes, so if you do have questions, please just scribble away, and we'll be calling for them to come to the end of the aisle soon. Let's spend a minute on this idea of being countercultural. I mean, if there is a countercultural media figure in America, it's you, right? I mean, you are.
I like that.
You are stubbornly untimely, and I know this because I think to myself, you know, occasionally, wow, I have a great idea that hooks to this piece of news. I'm going to call Krista and see if she'll have me on the show, and I always get an email back. Thanks for trying, but we don't deal with timely issues, right? So I wanna.
That's, okay, this is, I'm gonna correct you in a minute. Keep going.
But there is great intention to that, and there is great wisdom to that. But I'd love to unravel this mystery a little bit. Talk about the what and the when of your show, which is to say, how you choose the subjects you choose and when you do those stories. What's the wisdom behind that?
It's not a religion news show. It is a news show. It's journalism. But what we don't do and what we in fact resist is leaping on a story because there's a religion angle. Often when there's a religion angle to a story, the way it gets covered, it's not what I think is the real religion angle. But we have to let that exhaust itself. We have to let that play itself out. And there's often a larger religious, moral, spiritual angle to subjects that enter our public discourse. But we need to let the initial, you know, the initial news reporting, the initial fact-finding, the initial outrage or whatever of the news, we need to let that have its moment. And then I think we like to see ourselves as the ones who take a breath and then say, okay, let's talk about some other things that are at stake here. And sometimes it takes quite a while for us to find the voice. And I would give two examples. And one is a program we did just a couple of weeks ago on stem cells with a cardiac researcher. So stem cells is one of these issues that got polarized with very strident voices on both ends, and it kind of, you know, eventually was portrayed that there are two ways to think about this. You're either killing babies or you're killing Michael J. Fox, and there's no in between. And you know, what I started to learn was that stem cells, what I learned from this woman I interviewed, who I finally found her, so I was looking for her for years, right, and I finally found her. What she helped me understand is that stem cells, almost like DNA, is this very new thing we've learned about our bodies, and that I right now have stem cells coursing through my 49-year-old body, repairing organs, and not quite at the rate of my 11-year-old son. But she's growing organs, and they might one day. So there are all kinds of things coming. Anyway, the point is, there's all kinds of information we didn't get because we latched on to this great debate, which actually shut down the issues. And another example would be, and we talked about this today when I was with you, with your colleagues, was torture, right? Clearly, there are moral and spiritual issues in terms of torture, but with that one, we sat back and tried to figure out, well, how do we want to take that on? And it seemed to me that there was something deficient in the moral discussion being, well, does it work? Right? I mean, a lot of our discussion was, well, can we justify torture because it works? But you know, we needed to let that go. We needed to let that be out there. We needed to let that discussion take place. And then I found this person who's an expert in torture and also comes from an Iranian family where his own family was implicated in torture. So it's something that he's lived with and has layers of wisdom about. And his moral concern was, what does he know about what torture does to the torturer? And what does torture do to democratic societies who sanction it? So my favorite quote of Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, in a democracy, while some are guilty, all are responsible. I mean, I would apply that to a lot of the great issues before us, but it certainly is something we need to take in terms of this issue of torture. What did we do, and what effect has it had on us? And so that's the way we think about big issues in the news. And we may get to it 3 weeks from now, probably at the earliest, but we may get to it 3 years later. I mean, that's not to say that we don't sometimes. I remember when the monks were marching in the streets of Burma a couple of years ago, and that was one where I searched and searched, and I actually found this amazing woman who was a scholar of Burmese Buddhism and also had spent time as a nun in a Burmese Buddhist monastery. So, you know, that's that line I'm always walking. I care about, we don't have people talk about something. We have people talk out of, from the middle of. So she had that experience of really having a great body of knowledge and also an experience of being inside that tradition. And that was one where I felt like we were seeing these pictures of monks marching on the streets, and I really wanted for myself in that moment to know what does that mean? Explain to me what Buddhism is in Burma and what motivates these monks and what are some of the dynamics between religion and politics in that culture. And that was one we did pretty quickly, but I still think that was 3 weeks out.
I have this image of, you know, Olbermann and Hannity chasing a news story physically, right? And getting so sweaty and then dropping out of fatigue after 100 yards, and then Krista Tippett strolling by, taking her time.
No.
You know? But I love that. Look,
okay.
I have to tell you how
I
much...
Sometimes I feel frustrated, but...
You know, I mean, it's... One thinks of the pace of religion. You know, there are stories of religious figures saying, you know, my church thinks in centuries. That's an era, right? Not a news cycle, a century. So we'll consider what you're saying. We'll get back to you in a decade.
I have a sacred sense of time.
Right.
So,
good.
Yeah.
Good. So let's talk about another spiritual practice as it relates to your show. And I'll tell a personal story on this. When we met in the Twin Cities a couple years ago, you walked in carrying a thick book, and I said, "Now, Krista, what are you reading?" And you said, "I'm reading Abraham Joshua Heschel." And I said, "You know, light bedtime reading." And you said, "No, I'm preparing for a show." And I expressed shock that you were actually reading the book in preparation for the show.
Because
instead
you've
of reading,
been interviewed so
Because
much.
I've been interviewed by the media, and you know, they read the 6 quotes that their producer gives them before I go on air. But you actually read the books. Tell us about that practice of preparation, and not just the mechanics of it, but you know, what is Krista Tippett trying to do before she steps into the interviewer's chair?
Okay, well, I love science fiction, all right? And by the way, my light bedtime reading is science fiction or murder mysteries. Well-written murder
Confess
mysteries.
Away.
I think of how I go into an interview as a Vulcan mind melt for the Star Trek fans out there, which is, I am I do read as much as I possibly can, and I don't just read the last book someone wrote. I try to look at much of what they've written. Now, when it's somebody like Heschel, that's a little tricky. But I'll also read other interviews they've given, and the point of that is to try to feel like I can get a sense of who they are and how they think, so that when we sit down to talk, they will be able to relax into that inviting and trustworthy space where I get it. I get what they're saying. And therefore, we won't spend a lot of time explaining, we can go deeper. And so that's what the preparation is about, as much as it's about formulating really great questions. Because if it's a really great conversation where they are open and revealing and we are discovering something together and maybe putting words about something around something that they've never quite put words around that way before, then the beautiful questions I formulated aren't going to matter, because I'm listening and the questions are coming out of the conversation.
I think I'm being given the signal about note cards. So if you have a question and you've scribbled it on the note card, pass it to the end of the aisle. There are wonderful ushers who are taking them. One of the things I love about your book is you talk about these inspiring figures and dimensions of the Christian tradition. But you also talk about your encounters with Buddhism, with Islam. What have you learned about other traditions through everything from the spirituality of your childhood to your professional role in speaking of faith?
Well, that's a big question. This this method that I learned, when I went with this idea to public radio in 1998 for a program on a religion, I'd been doing an oral history project for an amazing Benedictine abbey in the middle of Minnesota called St. John's Abbey. And I had interviewed about 55 people across the spectrum of the Christian church over a two-year period, and I'd done it in the way they talk about these things in Collegeville at this Benedictine Abbey, which they call the first-person approach, which is not dealing in abstractions about God, but linking religious ideas and human experience. And now, these 55 people were as different as they could have been. They were Nazarene holiness to Armenian Orthodox. They could not have had less in common in some cases, but they were all Christian. And I knew that if we did this for public radio, and I wanted to do this, it needed to be about the fullness of this part of life in all its diversity. And I, frankly, it was a little bit of a... It felt a bit experimental for me to take something that I knew had worked. I knew how to have a certain kind of conversation with Christians and draw them out, and for it to be very revealing and nourishing and exciting, and that it was, you know, that it was funny and thoughtful, and that I knew that people listening, even if they were in a very different place, would find these interesting conversations. But I didn't have a lot of experience in terms of this kind of formal conversation with people of other traditions. And I mean, that's been so thrilling. Now, of course, what I didn't know when I started this is that the month we were set, when we'd finally gotten our funding to become a monthly show, was September 2001. And we'd created a show on the death penalty. Because there'd been some, I can't remember what happened, Timothy McVeigh, I think, was executed that summer or something. Well, we shelved that. And I was actually in Washington at the Pew Charitable Trusts on September 11th. I was in the Dulles Hilton, and the meeting never happened. I had a rental car and I drove back to Minnesota, thinking all the way about, I had this little hour of radio, and what were we gonna do? And I wanted to do something about Islam right away. But the incredible thing is, the vice president of news sits me down at his office. I think I had a little bit of post-traumatic, you know, shock. I was like, shaking when I got back. I'd driven for 2.5 days. He's like, so all this time, nobody had bought this. There were just mostly skeptics about a show about religion, right? And then that day, I go in 3 days after 9/11, and he says, "There's a hunger in this industry for what you know." And meanwhile, I was completely overwhelmed by how do we do this? How do we take this on? I want to do something about Islam, and then they wanted me to do something called Where Was God? Which we did. But if you, in my wildest dreams, when I first went in with this idea, I would never have thought we would do a show on public radio that would be picked up by 150 stations called Where Was God? But that conversation with Islam had to start, and I was very aware that it was starting under the, you know, under terrible circumstances. And yet, from the very beginning, it was so, so beautiful and so moving to me. And now, if I listened now, in fact, I did try to listen recently to that show we did in September 2001, and it was just, it felt so primitive to me, because it was. I had a learning curve, just like everyone else. But that has now become an extended conversation, and I have an extended conversation with Buddhists, with Jews, of course. I mean, Judaism is this tiny tradition, but it's this core tradition of both Christianity and Islam in very fascinating ways. You know,
large tradition, tiny community.
Large tradition, yeah. You know, Hinduism, I mean, there are traditions we haven't gotten to yet. And plus, one thing I always emphasized is we're really also about doing the diversity within the great traditions. So the diversity within Christianity, within Judaism, within Islam. And that also takes time. I mean, you know, that's where I get really impatient with how much we still have to do.
One of the things that I realize in doing the work that we do at the Interfaith Youth Corps is the number of people who get their information from religion from the evening news,
mm-hmm.
right? Which is to say that, you know, the first time a lot of people thought about who a Muslim was and what Islam is, this is a 1400-year-old tradition and a fifth of humankind, was on September 11th. And the obvious question, and it's a reasonable question, is what the hell is wrong with these people, right? But I wanna, if that's the only thing you know, then that's a reasonable question. But part of what you offer us is a spiritual practice of questioning. So as you were driving home, as you were driving from Dulles to Minnesota in September of 2001, what were the questions shaping up in your mind about this tradition that a lot of people were learning about?
Well, I was learning too. I didn't know much about Islam. What I did know, I don't think I've thought about this before. I was very clear, even though I didn't know much about Islam, that this was not an expression of the heart of Islam. You know, people say, part of the answer to the question, why is religion so dangerous, is because religion is a powerful aspect of human life. And it can be manipulated by very dark places in us. And it can be especially dangerous when it gets manipulated and co-opted by dark places in us. And I was very clear that that's what had happened. One thing that I'm talking about a lot now when I'm out, and because I feel like it's really important for Americans to get, is we have had a fixation that comes from Protestant Christianity on understanding other religions by understanding what they believe, which really doesn't tell you that much about anyone. But what I started to learn right away after 9/11 is, for example, Islam is not a verbal tradition. Judaism also. Islam is a faith of daily lived piety. It's not wordy. I mean, I'm telling you this, but Americans wanted Muslims to stand up and talk in a way, in just the way they did, and the way a Christian would, about what this meant and why these people were evil, and they wanted them to be asking the where was God question. And in fact, That's not a Muslim question, and talking about evil, the word evil itself has connotations of looking at the evil within. And that's not to say that Muslims weren't experiencing all the same human reactions, but the vocabulary was different. The articulation of it was going to be different. And that also got us off to a bad start. That made it really difficult to start learning.
You did this. There is a dimension of language in Islam, from the Quran through the poets. And you did this beautiful interview with my friend and colleague Omid Safi,
right,
on Muslim love poets.
Yes.
And I just found that such an interesting approach in the wake of September 11th.
Well, what I realized is we had to say, not what do Muslims believe, that question wasn't going to get us very far. It was going to yield an unsatisfying answer. But so then, what is the spiritual core of this tradition? And I found that the spiritual core is also aesthetically very rich. You know, it's poetic, it's intellectually rich, it's very different. And the Quran is not a book, you know, in the same way. There's recitation of the Quran. The Quran is experienced orally through the ears, not through the cerebral faculties. You know, okay, here's something. My grandfather, Southern Baptist preacher, you know, he would constantly pick out his favorite verse of James and quote it at you. And that was a legitimate thing to do. I mean, it's not that that's a really wonderful thing to do with the New Testament, but you can. You can pluck out a verse and give it to someone as the answer. It doesn't happen in Islam. I mean, I think there was such violence in a Muslim imagination. It was so unnatural. It is so unnatural in Islam to pluck out an idea about the Prophet or a verse from the Quran and say, this is Islam. I speak in the name of Islam. Even that, no one speaks in the name of Islam. But we, Americans who didn't know about Islam, didn't know enough to understand that. So it was this kind of, you know, very laborious backward, going back to a place where we could even start to learn. And I think we're still in that place.
No. The great anthropologist Clifford Geertz talks about something called modes of discursivity. And he says that, you know, there's people who say things, and then there's people who invent ways of saying things, if you will. And it seems to me that that's what you're doing. You are inventing, perhaps continuing, a way of talking about religion that has you as its leading exponent, but has a community of discourse, if you will, your audience. And they are learning this way of thinking about, questioning, talking about religion. So let me ask a very challenging question. As religion generates heat on the evening news every night, and the most recent example of heat is the trauma at Fort Hood, what do you, in your deepest hope, wish that your audience, how would they talk about Fort Hood? How would they think about Fort Hood?
Okay. I hope that one thing we foster, one thing I strive for in sometimes how we reframe issues that I feel have been narrowed by the way they've been framed, is in gathering some perspective. Whether that's just the perspective to take a breath and ask ourselves if the questions that are out there are really the questions we should be asking, or if what are out there as the main images are really the things we should be looking at. Getting some historical perspective on how we got from A to B. So, you know, part of my answer to that is not very spiritual, but it is that I'm very aware that Islam is 700 years younger than Christianity, and that 700 years ago, Christianity was in the throes of its own turmoil, of violence. You know, Christians were burning people at the stake and waging holy wars. this phenomenon of a great religious traditions in the throw of turmoil, like, in other words, is not new. It's not that it hasn't happened before. But this one is happening to Islam, and it's happening in the 21st century, where we are globalized, where we have mass communications, where we have very dangerous weapons. And so there's a sense in which the internal crisis among Muslims, which is a human crisis, but it's happening within the context of this tradition, it affects all of us. So it's not just the lives of Muslims that are at stake. And I don't, you know, I do what I can with my radio show. I don't have a prescription. I just think that Islam's crisis is our crisis too. I'm also really aware, and again, this is not a terribly spiritual answer, but that for many reasons, this is it's a very traumatic thing to be Muslim right now. And we also have to remember that most of the majority Muslim countries have just, in the last few decades, come out of experiences of colonialism, right? So there are layers of trauma here. I think that this man in Fort Hood who did the shooting, I mean, I think that's clearly a personal tragedy, right? It's an individual human life that has unraveled. But there is a backdrop there of the trauma of Muslims in our time, which is much bigger than any individual life, and which in a way is all of our business. So I would want there to be some perspective that doesn't in any way justify that violence, but moves a little bit beyond just a demonization or generalization. And I would want, you can be appalled at the violence and the suffering that's been caused, and also full of grief at the unraveling of the life of this man who did the shooting. Those two things can be held together. Those two compassionate responses can be held together. And I think that's probably the most spiritual thing I have to say on that.
So I have one last question, and then we're going to turn it over to the questions on these note cards. I love the way you talk about your grandfather, and I love the way you talk about him preaching fire and brimstone from the pulpit, but his beautiful mind and his warmth and his generosity. And there's a lot of people out there like your grandfather. So imagine your grandfather driving through Middle America, going a little bit too far to the left on his radio dial, and landing on Speaking of Faith. And after he gets past the "Krista, you come back home" reaction, what is the show doing for his mind and his spirituality?
Well, I like to fantasize about that. I'll just tell you a story. I got in the mail last year, I got a letter and a book from a Southern Baptist minister in the Deep South, I think Alabama. And it was a book that he had helped write introducing Islam to Christian children. And I have to think that in his theology, he is at the very least uncertain about whether Muslims are going to heaven, right? Because that's what the theology says. But he has done this because he said he was so disturbed by the hatred that he saw Christian people exhibiting towards this religion of Islam and towards Muslim people, and that is not Christian. And so, you know, in a way, it's a way of circumventing the theology. The theology stands, but more important than whether he's right or wrong, in being Christian, was that he should combat hatred and that he should bring Christians to the best in themselves. And I loved that. And I wrote him a long letter, and we've continued to correspond. And I wrote to him and I said, you know, I'm so thrilled that you're doing this. Thank you for sending it to me. My grandfather was a Southern Baptist minister, and I'd like to think that if he were still practicing his ministry today, he might have had a similar response. That was the most hopeful little thing that's happened that's made me imagine about my grandfather.
And it makes me think there's a great line by Tony Campolo, the great evangelical preacher. He says, it's more important to be right in the heart than right in the head. Mm. And this guy might have thought he was violating his theology, but there was something deeply Christian in any case about writing a generous book about Muslims. Well, we appreciate you being right in the heart and in the head and coming here and sharing with us. And I'm going to give you a little bit of a break, drink some water, give folks a stretch break in their seats, and I'm going to order some note cards and get ready to ask some audience questions. And our radio audience, prepare to ask your kitchen table mate your question while I prepare to ask Krista a set of new ones.
She's a producer. That's her job.
Okay, we're going to ask Krista some audience questions here. And I want to start with one that actually, Krista, you've been thinking a lot about recently. We didn't get a chance to get into in my set of questions, so I'm glad that somebody put it right here on a note card. Talk about the question of science versus religion. And the way the question is phrased here is the question of science versus religion irrelevant? But, you know, approach that any way you might, the science and religion discussion.
Okay. That's a debate, a conflict that was framed as a conflict and a debate, and I simply don't accept it, and I'm not interested in engaging the conversation in that way. I actually have a book coming out in March, which is called Einstein's God, and it's centered around some of my conversations with scientists, because that has also been an incredibly thrilling and rich and kind of evolving discussion for me and piece of learning for me. And it's been interesting because when I first started out, I looked around and I abundantly found scientific thinkers who also had some kind of religious perspective. You know, John Polkinghorne, the quantum physicist, who's also an Anglican priest, who can talk about the end times or prayer or the nature of God, and he can bring that all together with what he knows about quantum physics and chaos theory. I remember talking with Lori Zoloth, who's an Orthodox Jewish bioethicist, and she's talking about walking down the hallways, thinking about the Jewish teachings on how you create life by finding the lost letters of the Book of Life, and these scientists she's working with are working with the letters of DNA. So that was amazing. But as we have continued on, I have found that scientists, even who are not themselves religious thinkers, are just throwing out these spiritually and theologically evocative discoveries. that can be the stuff of theology in the 21st century. So I don't know if any of you remember a conversation I had about a year ago with a young theoretical physicist named Jana Levin, who's, you know, she's working on the shape and finitude of the universe, and she'd written this book about in the history of mathematics and how scientists can think about what, how we can know what is real and what is true. Well, those are philosophically and theologically evocative questions. And just as fascinating as that, you now have scientists who are investigating altruism, empathy, forgiveness, looking at our brains, like the most cutting-edge things that science is learning about the brain. These things are illuminating core virtues of religious tradition, taking them definitively out of the realm of idealism and helping religious people, perhaps, if we can be attentive to this, and I think there's so much to learn, you know, how forgiveness can really work and why sometimes it doesn't work and how we can nurture the conditions where forgiveness prevails over revenge. So I think that this is one of the most, one of the richest, most exciting, you know, it's not even necessarily a conversation, because it's theologians and scientists are, in some places they're talking to each other, but it's not even about that. It's about these ricocheting ideas. And I am a, you know, delighted observer of that. And I look forward to just kind of bringing these voices and these ideas onto the airwaves so that more of us can hear them and take them in and figure out some of the things that are being learned, you know, in astronomy and physics and biology and neuroscience that we can actually use in our everyday lives and in our spiritual sensibility. That's where I am.
Exciting book. There's a couple of fascinating questions about the spiritual but not religious descriptor. And I think some of the people in the audience might have thought that what you were saying about amateur theologians fed into this. So maybe just say a word about that. Is this notion of people being amateur theologians, does that lead itself to this notion of spiritual but not religious? And then maybe spend a moment on this notion of spiritual but not religious. And the two specific questions around this are, what is there a cost when it comes to, as far as watering down a religious tradition? And is there a sense of if people are not connected deeply to a tradition, they're not, there's a lack of accountability, if you will. Mm-hmm. Complex set of questions, but.
Sure, these things can get watered down, and sure, they can be superficial. I do sense that we're in quite a different era now than we were in the 1980s, where you had this new age, pick and choose, smorgasbord spirituality. I mean, you know, there's some of that that goes on, and that's going to happen when we have all this diversity and people are learning, picking up vocabulary, or, you know, anybody can meditate, anyone can do yoga. Does that make you Buddhist or Hindu? No, but in, you know, in some cases, these are spiritual technologies that I think lend themselves to us as human beings. I do actually feel that some of the most rigorous and intense theological thinkers I meet are people who don't quite identify with a tradition. So I don't think it's, you know, that it necessarily means that because you're not associated with a tradition, you don't have depth. I also, by the way, do not believe that that you stop having an ethical life or even a spiritual life in the absence of a belief in God. There are a lot of people in our culture who've been wounded by religious institutions, and I take that seriously. But as I said before, I also often see people who really investigate, who are amateur theologians, who read, who test, and who eventually circle back to some kind of religious community or tradition, maybe even the one they came from in the first place, but with a whole new set of questions and with a lot more substance. because religious traditions are keepers of things like sacrament and ritual and community relationship that we need as human beings as well as religious practitioners. So there is such a thing as spiritual, not religious. But I don't quite, I think there's much more of a kind of fluid interplay with them across people's lifespans and across the lifespan of our culture than we necessarily see. And I also love this, last year I interviewed this Unitarian Universalist chaplain. She's a chaplain to the Game Wardens of Maine. She's the person who's called out, actually in very dramatic circumstances, where a child disappears in the woods or someone, you know, is on their snowmobile and they go down in the ice. She said, people talk about being spiritual, not religious. I'm religious, but not spiritual. I have no time for this touchy-feely stuff. But she said, what that means for her, and here's the rub. The way we define, I believe these words, religious, spiritual, faith, I think every single person sitting here would define those three words differently. And, you know, this vocabulary is really loaded and it's difficult because there are no accepted definitions. And I think we work out the definitions of these things life by life. For her, what that meant, religious, not spiritual, is that what she knows about God, she can only take away from what she sees in what happens between human beings. It's tangible, it's physical, it's incarnational, it's embodied. But every one of us would have a different way of distinguishing between those things.
It's an interesting connection to this next question. I'm just going to read it as it is because it's rich enough as it is. It doesn't need me to mess with it any. Why do humans seem to need a God? We seem to call up a God at certain times only. What would life be like without this concept? Wouldn't it be okay? What about countries or societies that are atheistic?
Yeah, well, that's one of those things that scientists are studying as well. I don't have an answer. It's true that people, human beings, will turn to God in moments of crisis, and you can say, and you can infer from that perhaps God is something we invent, that we perhaps need God. I also think another way to look at it is that we don't, especially in this culture, allow ourselves to know our vulnerability very often. We deny that as much as we possibly can. But there are these moments in life, in crisis, in illness or loss, where we stand in the presence of finitude and frailty and vulnerability, mortality, these things we don't like to think about, which have to do with life and death writ large, and that if there is a God, it's not surprising that in those moments we're perhaps more open to that kind of knowledge. But I absolutely see that you can look at these things both ways. But there, you know, there is this part of life that we call religious, that we call spiritual. It does find expression in just about every culture that I know of. I'm fascinated by the fact that that is true, that that's so pervasive. I'm also fascinated by the different manifestations of it, the vastly different vocabulary and practices that have come out of this part of life that human beings call religious and spiritual, and I'm fascinated by that, even though I can't necessarily answer this question definitively.
Let me give you another question you might not be able to answer definitively. In fact, I have a stack of them.
Mm-hmm.
It's how do we not demonize the religious other within our own tradition? And let me just contextualize that. So we are in a well-known, a nationally well-known mainline Protestant church, which probably hews towards the progressive on some things. Let's say that's my interpretation of it. Reverend Buchanan is staring at me with some interpretive difference, but let me just say that's my interpretation. How does a community like this not demonize your grandfather?
That's hard. That's actually a really good question, because it's much harder to be compassionate towards the people we're closest to. It's harder to be compassionate towards that cousin who disagrees with you on something like gay marriage or abortion, right? These emotional issues, than it is to be compassionate towards someone on the other side of the planet. This is not really an answer to the question, but I would say that the responses we get to the show that make me happiest are when people say that they've been able to have a conversation that they couldn't have before with someone they disagreed with, who was close to them. Not that listening to the show brought them any closer in their positions, but that they were able to talk to each other. And I think when those kinds of breakthroughs happen, the issues have been humanized. People have been able to start talking to each other again as human beings rather than as representatives of something we disagree with. And so whatever we can do to humanize issues, to meet someone at a human place, even if you leave that disagreement, even if that disagreement comes into the room with you. That's where you can at least start to walk forward into the future together, right? Like, not disagreeing, but living forward into the hope of reconciliation. We're so impatient in this culture. We have really, really big, hard questions that we don't have answers for right now. And definitions of things like sexuality and marriage and family and, you know, how our institutions should be structured and what government is and what politics is and what community is and what relationship is and how we can be stewards of our environment. We have these huge complex issues, and part of what we need to do is cultivate a virtue of patience and just take, you know, move forward together on what we can work on today.
So this question connects two intimate and uncomfortable topics and presents them to you for a roadmap. How do we talk about money and resources in light of our faith and spiritual lives? Do a show on this?
We've done a couple of shows on money. You know, I've had kind of a cop-out attitude to money for a lot of my life, which is it's not important to me, I don't want to think about it. But that doesn't get you anywhere. It gets you into trouble. You know, money, who was I? Rachel Naomi Remen, we did this series after the economic downturn last year on the moral and spiritual aspects of economic crisis. Kate, where are you? What did she say? Money is human energy. What did she say? It's, yeah.
Rachel Naomi Remen said that
Kate's my producer. She makes everything possible.
She said that the question, where do I find meaning and what do I value, are the questions that we are asking ourselves during the economic crisis, and they are also the questions that launch a spiritual journey.
Right. And remember, she had this definition of money. She said something like, money is... it's human energy. It's like human energy. What did she say?
She said money was a consolidation of human energy.
Right.
That it came from human labor, from human effort, and that it was a kind of embodiment.
Right, that it was kind of an embodiment.
Yeah.
And, yeah, okay. Hi. If you're interested in the show, it's good that you saw this exchange, because I need Kate all the time. That helped me. We've turned money into something that's so removed from anything real. But it's currency, right? I mean, we don't even take that word seriously. I don't have a lot of wisdom about that.
Nor do I. Part of the function of not having a lot of it, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Talk about how speaking of faith has affected your spiritual life. And there's an interesting second question, which is, speaking of faith is necessarily public, right? And there's a huge dimension of spirituality, which is private. Mm-hmm. So how do you think about your spiritual life in relation to this public thing that you do and in the solitary places that mm-hmm. you nurture as well?
And honestly, I find myself uncomfortable when I'm asked that question, but partly because the show is public, and even though I'm paid to ask other people to reveal this about themselves, I'm in the conversation as a journalist. In terms of my, but I will, I'll give a stab at it. I mean, I find a word like God to be so, it's just too small for all the different connotations and echoes and lives and ideas that I now attach to it. I find I have this delight in the fact that at the core of all of the great traditions, there is a reverence for mystery. You know, right there alongside the orthodoxy, they tell us that there are things we are never going to fully comprehend in this lifetime. And the longer I do the show, the more comfortable I am. And with that, with mystery, and grateful for that. And I guess the final thing I would say, something that's on my mind a lot these days is, because I pursue these ideas as they are lived and breathed, you know, as they find expression in lives, that imperative to real integrity, to three-dimensional integrity, comes back to me. And I've thought a lot these last years about how in Western religion in particular, we've kind of turned it into something that happens from here up. And I think that one reason you see this explosion of things like yoga, and I talked to one of your colleagues today who's been doing karate, and the fact that a lot of the traditions that are growing fastest in the world, like Pentecostal Christianity, like Islam, are embodied traditions, where prayer is embodied, where the wholeness of life is taken in, and it's not a set of beliefs. It doesn't pretend to be a set of beliefs or aspire to be a set of beliefs. There's something mysterious about that. But I think that there's something in us as human beings, and it used to be there. Religion used to be a cathartic experience, right? Mind, body, spirit, singing, dancing, crying, laughing. Now, we sit up straight in pews. And so I see people reaching for that, recovering that, sometimes inside their tradition, sometimes outside it. And I find that that's become more and more important to me. And there's something very, that I can't explain. Maybe I'll write a book about this in 10 years. I have this sense that we are limited in our capacity to experience mystery by how fully we're living in our bodies. I have a feeling that, I've heard this from people like, yoga, this Matthew Sanford, this person I interviewed who's been paraplegic since he was 13 and is a great master teacher of yoga, and he said he had learned that it's only when we are fully in our bodies that we can have that the more fully we are in our bodies, the more compassionate we'll be towards other living beings. Right? We think of compassion again as this kind of head trip, as this intellectual ascent, but there's something embodied. I think compassion and some of these great virtues become more rooted and more real. I think that we need to be living closer to the ground in order for environmental crisis really to come home to us, that we need to experience ourselves as creatures, you know, in a sense, and that when we do, that crisis in the natural world is not an abstraction anymore. And that for us to really take this on, it's going to have to stop being an abstraction. So that's kind of a mystery that's there for me, but that I'm really loving.
Hmm. As you talk about the kind of physicality of faith, hmm. I think about the great story that Bill Moyers tells in the introduction to his interviews with Joseph Campbell. He overhears this New York social philosopher talking about his time in Japan, and he says to this Japanese Shinto priest, you know, we've been to your shrines and we've studied your books, and it's all fascinating. Tell us about your theology. And the Shinto priest says, I don't think we have theology the way you think we have theology. We dance. You know?
Yeah.
So there's these different expressions of spirituality.
Yeah.
So one last question, Krista, and on the note card, it says, in all the interviews you do, it's kind of the sum total. Does it lead you more to hope or more to despair?
Oh, come on. You know,
hey,
really.
I have a...
What am I going to say? Despair.
Well, tell us why.
It leads me to hope.
Tell us why.
I'm looking for hope, too, right?
It's not a bad thing.
Okay. So I love this... I love this phrase that's in the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament about developing eyes to see and ears to hear. I think that's a really critical spiritual discipline for the 21st century, developing eyes to see and ears to hear, because we are bombarded by images and information and ideas and words, and they're all coming at us. And a lot of them are, if you talk about the news, the news is what goes wrong, right? That's how the news is defined. And so part of what I am looking to find and to shine a light on is the other kind of news. I'm looking for wisdom. I'm looking for people who are, who have something to say that is going to be nourishing and edifying. Those are words I like, nourishing and edifying. I'm looking for lives of integrity. I'm looking for hope. And if you're looking for hope, you find it. But you do have to look. There's an effort involved. It's absolutely worth the effort. I mean, it's out there to see. I will say, I make a distinction between optimism and hope. You know, I don't consider myself an optimistic person. I'm hopeful, and that's more realistic in a sense. I mean, that's based on reality, on real faces and real voices and real stories. I also, I love this story. And some of you know Joan Chittister's great Benedictine nun social activist. You know Joan?
Mm-hmm.
So she tells this story that she says to me, so in 6th century Rome, right, civilization is crumbling. There was not a headline written, Benedict writes rule. Okay? I mean, you know, over in some obscure little place, you know, Benedict, who was, I think, one of the communities he tried to found, they tried to poison him. I mean, this guy was not a success by anybody's standard. But somewhere in the 6th century, he writes this rule that gives rise to this monastic tradition that, oh, by the way, at some point saves Western civilization. I have hope in the fact that I probably, even with all my resources of this great public radio show, this, you know, the resources of public radio that I have a media platform, I suspect that I don't know what is the most important thing happening in the world today that may save civilization 1,000 years from now. And I have a lot of hope in that, too. That's exciting to me.
I love this notion of looking for hope, and I think what you have tapped into is a community of lookers for hope. And you are, in many ways, a leader of that community of lookers for hope. And so we've looked to you to lead, and we appreciate your presence with us.
I am very honored by all of you. It's incredible to look at and see you. And I also want to thank WBEZ, our fantastic public radio partners here, and Fourth Church, and everybody who helped plan this. It was a real collective effort. And thank you again for listening and for coming tonight. Thank you for being here.